The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
The moon, yeah. That's Hugo, tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-o! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me today we have BFM's very own Uma Parkin, MPK Parkin.
Hello, Cam.
And we have the return of educator, musician, and all-round Renaissance man, Azmil Yunor.
Hello.
I like the word raconteur.
Raconteur, is he?
Yes, he is.
He's here in his dinner jacket. Our three topics this week will be, topic number one is Saturday morning cartoons. Topic number two is Blade Runner 2049. And finally, topic number three will be lo-fi. Uma. Saturday morning cartoons. Remind young people what the hell that is.
Well, I will tell you where this came from, first of all, and why I wanted to talk about this. I was at one of these events, if you will, where I was asked to talk to young students. Well, I say young. They were about maybe 19 through 21-ish. And one of them had asked me, oh, you know, what were your big influences growing up? And I was like, oh, you know, I like reading a lot and I like watching movies a lot, and all of these cultural influences were there, along with the more traditional influences that my parents exposed me to, right? All the Indian Hindu type stuff as well. And then I realized actually one major influence that I never talk about is Saturday morning cartoons. So for the young kids who don't know about television, you know, things never used to be on demand. Basically, on Saturday morning, we had free reign in my house of the TV. On the weekdays, you know, there was always limited viewing time. But on Saturday mornings, literally, we were the cliche. Bowl of sugary cereal, you sit down and you've got Transformers, G.I. Joe, those early X-Men cartoons, My Little Pony, Care Bears, all of that stuff, right? And literally, you sit there from like 8 in the morning until noon just watching this stuff. But after talking to these kids about the impact of Saturday morning cartoons and those theme songs that get stuck in your head and you're singing it and you're playing these things with your friends at schools, I realized actually there were... Because I went back and I went on streaming services and started to look up some of these things. Now, some of them have incredibly just dated really badly, but some of them are actually really still quite good. And I realized that there are a lot of moral lessons that were done in these cartoons, but in not such an obvious way that I find a lot of children's programming today does. Yeah. So they still focused on stories. And when you think of something like Transformers or G.I. Joe, these were shows that were really just created to sell toys. And they made no bones about it. They were really, you know, like, yeah, we have this toy line. Let's make a series of cartoons to sell it, right? But here's the thing. The values in there about, you know, friendship, teamwork, all of that stuff, it was actually quite subtly introduced into the storytelling. And watching these old cartoons, I'm like, huh, some of this stuff's actually quite well written.
I am worried, actually, with today's episode, this is going to be the grumpy old man issue. You know, looking back on yesteryear, when things were better.
We're not grumpy at all.
But are you bemoaning its loss, the loss of this?
No, not at all. I mean, what kids have today, I mean, maybe it does appeal to this generation as well. It's a completely different generation with different needs, wants, and likes. That's fair enough. What I'm saying is that I think I underplayed the importance of these seemingly inane pieces of marketing, right?
Yeah.
And when I look back upon it now, and I guess a lot of people talk about that movie of Transformers, the animated movie, which actually featured the voice of Orson Welles in it and a whole bunch of famous people. And people talk about that because, yet again, the series had come to a likely end and they were like, oh, you know, let's get rid of these old characters and start a whole new toy line. So we're going to make a movie.
But you know the story behind that, right? Where Optimus died and a lot of kids were crying.
Yeah.
And they brought him back.
And I remember that as well, right? I watched it on VHS and I was broken with that Optimus Prime had died.
Azmil, were you a Saturday morning cartoon kind of guy?
That too, and the 5:30 p.m. cartoons on weekdays.
Correct.
Yeah, I used to record them all on VHS tapes.
Although the 5:30 p.m. cartoons on weekdays... Yeah. Get interrupted for prayer time.
Yeah.
Right? There's a 5-minute break for prayer time and then it continues.
Yeah. But, so, but I think what's interesting that about that was that the consumption wasn't... I mean, yeah, of course, marketing has gone hyperdrive now. It's a different monster. But I think back then, we weren't discerning. You watch all the cartoons. You watch like Voltron, then...
Everything.
Care Bears. You watch it. You don't
care. You know, I'm slightly older than you. Uma. You and I are nearer the same age.
Really?
So it was a different. It was a different. Yes, you got long hair and everything, but let's just grow up. So it was a different set of cartoons. But I think that the thing about the Saturday morning one was that it wasn't just that here was a set time on the television schedule dedicated to kids, but actually also here was a set time where it's dedicated to kids, and it was in no way educational.
Mm. Yes.
You know, yeah. This was pure fun.
Entertainment. Yeah.
Entertainment. And the pressure was off to learn anything. I think also the pressure was off for the program makers as well. We don't have to educate them. They can just go and be kids.
And that's okay. Yeah.
That's okay. It's that okay. Was great.
Yeah.
But I also think there's a lot of subtle learning that goes along with these cartoons, even though there was really no pressure to educate.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's still there, right? Even though every episode may have the same moral message, that's besides the point.
Well, I like the fact at the end of every Transformers G.I. Joe, they will all huddle together and laugh.
Yes, correct.
There was a lot of what, sorry?
They huddle together and laugh.
Oh, okay. All right, right. So I've never watched this show. I've never watched it. For me, learning, education, well, I mean, in a more social sense, Scooby-Doo.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, that too. Yeah,
Scooby, the relationships in that show were so bizarre.
Yeah.
That, yeah, I mean, I was enjoying the drama and the mystery, but at the same time, I couldn't help wondering out, how do these people know each other?
Why do they hang out?
Why do they hang out? That girl's dressed kind of like not what I thought girls dressed like.
Yeah.
She's got really short hair. Looks a lot like Billie Jean King. And Shaggy was, why is he so goofy like that all the time?
It's all right, kids, for those of you who don't know, Billie Jean King. Yeah. No.
So that was an education.
And very progressive show, just to show that, you know, you could smoke a lot of grass and still get things done.
They ate Scooby snacks. That's a different thing.
They had great songs too, theme songs.
That's right.
That's also another thing that comes in the picture, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so Grumpy Old Man edition starts with a happy one where we remember yesteryear and the good times we had. And now, kids, we're going to move on to topic number two, which is Blade Runner 2049. Now, the 2049 indicates the amount of years that have passed since the original Blade Runner came out.
Correct.
Back in 1983, I think it was. Spoiler, I wouldn't say spoiler alert, nothing really much happens in the movie, so I can't really spoil it for you. But it stars Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford. It's a reworking and updating of the Blade Runner movie, which came out in 1993, where a Blade Runner, a man who tracks down and kills androids that have gone rogue, and now there's a new batch, and Ryan Gosling plays an android who is one of the tamed new variety. And 2.5 hours later, the movie ends. I just want to say, I love the original film.
Yes, you do.
It's one of my favorite movies. It blew my mind, man. And so I went to this movie with high expectations because everybody I respect was saying, this is one of the great movies of all time, and I was deeply disappointed. And talk about Blade Runner itself, I would like to focus my attention anyway on the soundtrack. The soundtrack for me was deeply disappointing, and it's indicative of all the problems with soundtracks in movies altogether. The original one had Vangelis.
It's a tremendous piece of music. Ooh,
beautiful.
Yeah.
It's melodic, but it's also atmospheric. It's a musical conversation with the movie. It's an accompaniment. It has themes that sort of evoke, etc. This one was just pure sound effects.
It was sound design more than soundtrack.
Yeah. And so why hire a person and call him a composer?
So I didn't mind that because I felt it fit with the film. So I loved the movie and I thought that, yes, I mean, you can't touch Vangelis. If you listen to that soundtrack, if you go to YouTube and you type in Blade Runner soundtrack, I think there's a 2-hour video or a 1.5-hour video that actually plays the entire soundtrack from beginning to end. And you realize what a masterpiece it is because Vangelis actually wrote the music for every scene. He wasn't a composer that went, oh, I'm going to write this hook and then reuse it over and over again throughout the film. He wasn't one of those people. No. That's why the music is so varied. The love theme is different from the main theme, from Deckard's theme, from the end theme. They were all so varied, right?
Yep.
In this one, Cam, did you not think that the sound design was what kind of drove the film?
It was... No.
No?
No, because sound design is great. I love sound design. Walter Murch, who did Apocalypse Now, he was the great sound designer. That's a job. But if you have a soundtrack, and I think that films don't have to have a soundtrack, especially when you follow on from the original Blade Runner with Vangelis, you need a soundtrack. Then I want to hear an orchestral piece, well, not orchestral, but a musical piece that is it's like an opera.
I guess burdened by the expectations, yes. I suppose. Probably that was a big part of it.
No,
I enjoyed it because Hollywood's been remaking a lot of stuff and just disappointed. But I came in, I mean, that wasn't a big
Did you like the original?
Yeah, I loved the original. Yeah. And of course, I didn't expect this to better that. But I felt that narratively, I think it was trying to allude to that this is after that, post.
You know, okay. The story was okay for you guys? Was it enough to hang a...
It was. I really enjoyed the story. I enjoyed how it built on the original. And, you know, we were talking about this after you saw it, Cam, and I think you raised an interesting point. There is nothing in this movie, if you haven't seen the original, you can debate whether it's worth spending $150 million on a film which isn't actually for everyone, because this is not a film for everyone.
No, it's not. It's only for the... You'd have to be 45 years or older. Seriously.
I think a fan of the film, right?
Yeah, and felt probably... It probably has an effect on...
I was watching the movie and imagining if I had not watch the original, and okay. I would just be, what is going on? You have no idea what the hell's going on. You're not engaged on any level whatsoever unless you've watched a film that came out in 1983.
Well, so here's the thing. I went with a couple of people who haven't seen the original Blade Runner, and they still seem to be quite enthralled by this film as well. And I think they were caught up by... Also, if you haven't seen the original Blade Runner and you're not a science fiction movie watcher... This does feel quite unique visually. I guess the resolution of plot. I mean, for me, it was a big movie on loss and sadness, right? Mm. That Deckard has lost his love. Kay has lost his pseudo love, if you want to call it. And how they both kind of resolve that issue with Kay finally realizing that I'm nothing and I have to help Deckard. That's my last, that's the only good I can do in this world, right? Mm. And so... I found that pretty moving, and I really enjoyed this movie. I've seen it like three times.
Serious?
It's 9 hours of my life.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it. I mean, beyond just the film and its history with the first Blade Runner, I thought the film's also a commentary on just the notion of simulacra. I mean,
notion of what?
Simulacra. We're trying to like you're watching it and you're trying. Okay, this is not as good as the past, you know. And certain people are expecting that they should better the past, and also the characters also there. They're trying to recreate. I mean, that was the holograph.
Oh, the joy.
Love scene. Love scene is, that's pretty mind-blowing, man. It's such a great visualization of this notion of, will we ever experience things as it is anymore?
Oh, okay.
So I thought that's why it's rich, I think.
I wasn't watching it deeply enough, was I?
You're going to watch it again, I think,
It's interesting you say that, because I went in with huge expectations as well, because I'm such a big fan of the original film. And I wasn't disappointed in that, also because, you know, it's been such a long time since I've seen a movie that's taken its own time to tell a story. We're used to everything just happening so fast and in your face all the time, that the pacing, the visuals, all of that really kind of...
And film of that sort of genre where the editing is kind of like, not rushed.
Jennifer, look, I liked the film. I think it's one of the best movies I've watched for a long time. I was just deeply disappointed.
I can understand that.
It's not as good as Villeneuve's earlier film, Arrival.
Oh, yes.
Arrival's a great film.
Amazing film.
I mean, we're going to talk about lo-fi in a moment. Compared to Blade Runner 2049, that's lo-fi. And it's much more intimate. Blade Runner had, I don't know, it felt like it was really going somewhere tremendous, but didn't really get there. Whereas the original Blade Runner, there were no expectations, and it just took you somewhere instantly to a new land where I think we can never go again.
True.
Just like nostalgia, I suppose. All right, so, and in a moment, we're going to do another bit of Grumpy Old Men here on A Bit of Culture, and we talk about lo-fi on Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Uma Parkin, Umpa K. Parkin, and Azmil Yunor. And now, Azmil, lo-fi.
Lo-fi, yeah. Low fidelity. I mean, the term lo-fi is often denoted more to musical approach, recording, technique. For me, I see it also culturally as a reaction to our society's fetish over everything HD, high D, high definition, looking realer than real. Our eyes don't see that real. We don't hear things that real. But sometimes that graininess is also where there's a lot of interesting things happening.
Lo-fi would be, it's technique, it's technology.
It's technology, yeah.
It's about recording on... Analog, old analog. Am I getting
this right?
So that's
process. But sometimes lo-fi can also be simulated, right? I mean, people, recording it on digital, but let's make it sound crackly, you know?
Right.
But I think the important thing for me about lo-fi is not so much the technology, actually. It's always been about the immediacy of capturing something, like recording something on even on your smartphone recorder. as grainy as it is. But if it's of the moment, I think that's lo-fi. So, you know, it's not about a battle between analog and digital. I think it's an approach. Yeah.
It's part of that ever-ongoing search for authenticity.
Authenticity,
We were talking earlier, Azmil, about lo-fi and hi-fi. And as you were talking about the recording, especially, the recording studio now can be in your bedroom. You can have in your bedroom with your computer everything and much, much more than the Beatles ever had at Abbey Road. I mean, they were starting off on 4-track and then they were like amazed when it went to 8-track, and by the end of their career they're on 16-track. The notion of a finite number of tracks on a computer is absurd. So a guy in his room recording with a guitar plugged into his, you know, his computer, that's lo-fi for today. But compared to the days of past.
But I mean, now when you say bedroom musician, it's completely decontextualized between, let's say, 90s. Somebody in a bedroom 90s would be on a 4-track, and it's really lo-fi. I mean, you weren't using it on a laptop. In fact, my last 3 albums were all pretty much, most of it was recorded in my friend's bedroom. Okay, but at the same time, the technology, like you said, is limitless. It's got a lot more options than probably a studio would have. Of course, you won't get the ambience. You know, you're singing, you're sitting on a friend's bed and singing over a sound thing that's made of pantyhose, you know, putting over over a clothes hanger.
We've all been there.
But nevertheless, that's why I think even the coming into the recording process is quite important. Like when you mentioned Brian Wilson, he recorded stuff you could say was lo-fi because you're making use of something that was limited and expanding it. But now we tend to approach recording coming in like, okay, I've got all this software, I've got this great stuff. Okay, now let's think about recording. I think we've got that process the other way around, I suppose.
Yeah.
I mean, like you mentioned Pink Floyd, they had all the abilities there. All you needed was to capture it, you know.
I think capturing it is important, and I don't think the medium in which you use to capture it is all that important. I think it's the act of capturing it that's probably the most important thing.
Exactly.
And I completely agree with you about immediacy that is quite lost. I mean, you know, Cam, last week I was listening to the show and Lynn was talking about Insta videos and Snapchat videos. And for me, that was a very interesting sense of immediacy. And I'm of two minds of that, if only because for me, when I create something, I want it to last. If not, I won't bother creating it, right? Meanwhile, the generation of today that prides themselves in Insta videos and Snapchat videos are essentially creating. They're capturing these immediate moments, but they only want it to last 24 hours. And then they're happy to see it completely disappear into the ether. And that doesn't compute for me. And which is why I think we actually have a lot of these lo-fi capturing abilities with us on our phones. You know, they may be digital devices, but they're actually used in a very lo-fi way for Instagram. Instagram, you take these thousands of photos everyone is taking every day, right? But it's a pretty dinky camera. It's a pretty crappy photo. And yet, it's a high-fidelity way of capturing something lo-fi.
Yeah, and I think also the playback in those instances is quite lo-fi because you take the photograph on your phone and you only ever look at it on your phone.
On something that tiny as well, right?
If you never print it out and blow it up.
And your phone, you know, whatever megapixel camera on your phone can actually blow up that photo probably to half the size of this room, but you never look at it.
I think that notion, even though it is almost like if it's instantaneous, it's disposable. That's kind of sad.
But it's very
for
sad.
For me, I mean, the lo-fi, I think, thing for me is that, it's instantaneous, but it's worth something. And that's quite important. I mean, I don't think it's disposable because something's lo-fi.
Yeah. Actually, one of the happiest memories in my life, actually, was many years ago, back in the 80s, when I was living in a house in London and a friend brought round a 4-track machine, 4-track deck. And this was like, whoa, there's a 4-track in our house. Can you imagine? And I was living with a bunch of musicians who were pretty good musicians. And I was playing the bass guitar at the time. Not terribly well, but just well enough. And so we wrote a song for my then girlfriend. And I wrote the song. And I was able to say to my friends, I want you to play like this, play like that. And I'll sing a little bit here. It was such fun. Because also when you play it, it goes instantly in. And if you wanted to double up, you'd have to put the drums and the guitar onto the same track. And then you're committed. And it was fun because you commit each time you do it.
I think that's the key word there. Commitment to capture. I think that's quite important. I think that is the aesthetic.
So this take is the take.
Yeah.
And we can't, it takes so long to go back and forth. We can't take all this time.
And that's, you're right. That's the one of the most frustrating. Okay, so here's the thing, right? I remember, you know, the Leica, the people who make cameras. I think about a year ago, they released the most ridiculously expensive, kind of on first glance, pointless thing. They released a digital camera, all right, which was something like 30,000 ringgit. And it didn't have any of the features that a digital camera had. It had no digital back. You couldn't see your photos. It had no menu system. It had nothing. You could put in an SD card. You couldn't even format the card in the camera. You could just put in the card like a piece of film to capture photos, and everything else was manual control. And you're thinking, for 30,000 ringgit, if I want to buy a digital camera, I'm sure there are hundreds of digital cameras that are one-tenth the price and yet as good. And yet I was reading reviews, and every photographer, every professional photographer that picked up this thing went, oh my God, it was a completely new experience, because I forgot what it was like to just look through that viewfinder and take a photo and not shoot 70 frames and then review each frame individually and then go, okay, I've got it.
No, but it wasn't wholly new. I mean, these are fellas who did grow up on that, though.
They did, and they forgot.
Right. Yeah. But how would it be for people who've never had that recollection whatsoever and just look at this thing and go, what the hell is this?
If you're that young, then you probably can't afford a 30,000 ringgit camera.
Yeah, but no, but the people who are that young now are going to be the old timers.
They are.
Soon enough. And if they choose to buy that camera, what are they? They're just being hipsters, what?
Maybe, but I don't know. I don't know if they're just being hipsters. I think some maybe they're truly committed to the art. But you're right. That instantaneous, that commitment that comes with the art of photography or the art of making music seems somewhat lost in this hi-fi age where everyone can do it because it's so much trial and error, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Can I just mention one more hi-fi experience from the 80s, which would be so lo-fi now, right? When I was working in film in the 80s, when we did the sound mix at the end of the movie, we had to get together all our different tapes and we would play them simultaneously if we had enough tracks, four tracks.
Right.
And then we would mix on the fly. So as the tapes are passing across the heads, you are moving the dials up and down. Mm. And you've got charts, you've rehearsed, the charts will tell you you're going to go up and down, but there's no going back.
Yeah.
You press the on button and you're off. Yeah. And everybody's moving around, moving up and down.
Yeah.
Any one mistake and the whole thing's ruined.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It was so cool.
That danger, man. I mean, that's lost now, because,
No fixing it in post.
Yeah, no
right.
No post.
Now,
yeah.
I've had that experience. I grew up with that.
Oh.
Right? So it's in my DNA.
Mm.
And people now, though, are building up their own memories, their own ideas of how things are done.
Of course.
Right? I mean, I don't know how they did it in the 1930s.
Mm.
I don't know. I don't care.
Mm.
Are we just, again, being the grumpy old men who are, like, looking back?
Well, I mean, besides that, I mean, there's also the aspect with the lo-fi thing. Sometimes it's also the scratches, the damages, the mistakes, they call it.
Oh, yeah,
it's also captured. Yeah, yeah. And you maintain that, because that makes us human. You know, now everything's so polished, everything. Or people are afraid to make mistakes. Mistakes are fine. And that's what I find really mind-blowing, is that people are more apologetic. Oh, sorry. But, you know, isn't that the beauty of it? We're human.
Yeah, because now you can get the Beatles things where they've isolated the tracks.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
And you can listen to the singing, the guitars, whatever, and you realize, hey, there are lots of mistakes.
Yeah,
that's out of tune. It's
fine. Yeah.
So there's a very funny story I have about a lo-fi, hi-fi situation. I went to a show outlet of a brand of stereo called Name. Okay. I don't know if you've heard of this brand. It's a very high-end British brand, and they make really amazing stereo equipment. So we went to one of their show houses, which is somewhere in the southwest of London. And on every, they have rooms set up to show you their different stereos. Mm. And so the guy put on a record, and I'm trying to think who it was. I think it was a Clapton record, or I don't know if it was a Traveling Wilburys record. And they were playing a slow song, right? And it was an incredible sound. And there was something that we hadn't heard before, and we were like, hey, we hear this occasional knocking sound. What is it? And he goes, oh, right, that's the sound of his watch hitting the guitar.
Ah, I see.
And I've never heard that before. And, you know, I mean that kind of imperfection, impurity, you can take out now.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm, yeah.
But you're right.
It enriches it.
Yeah, it enriches the experience.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, kids.
Make mistakes.
Yeah, put that in your Nintendo.
But that's not what we're saying, right, Cam? I don't think we're saying then was good, now is bad. I think the idea
No, I agree, Umar, it's not
no
about
carry
that.
On, Umar.
No, yeah. But I think the idea is that hey, we've got all this equipment now, we've got all this modernity now, and maybe if we apply that same sense of immediacy and commitment, those values to now, what could we achieve?
Yeah, right? Yeah, no, I don't think it can be done. I think the technology... No, seriously, the technology forces you. If you have a machine that can take 1,000 pictures, you're going to take 1,000 pictures.
Of course.
I'm not saying... Therefore, they're going to be stupid. I mean, you are
right. You
working
have,
with what you
why
have.
Why be stupid, right? You have the ability. Yeah. Why not use it?
Yeah, yeah.
I've got 9,000 photos on my phone. Yeah.
And have you printed
all
any
of them of his twins?
Have you ever printed any photographs?
I'm trying to.
I mean, no.
Well, Azrul right. has children right now, so he has to print photographs. Yeah, okay. That's right.
Okay, so that's lo-fi, if we ever see it like again. And now we move on, though, to the final part of the show, recommendations. Recommend something that we think might be of interest. And Uma's going first.
Am I going first? I went first the last time. I always go first. All right. I'm going to recommend a brand new TV show that I'm watching. It's not Stranger Things 2, even though I love Stranger Things 2. It's actually a show called Mindhunter. It's on Netflix. It's based on a book written by FBI agents. And this is the story of the investigation and discovery and study of the very first serial killers. This is the story on which all of these other serialized TV shows that you probably love, like Criminal Minds and all that stuff, is based on. Only these are the real guys, and this is the real deal. And it's, I want to call it fictionalized nonfiction, because it plays out like drama, but it's based on real events and based on the real-life exploits of these FBI people. So, yeah, I mean, from the early days of what is a serial killer to what makes a serial killer, it is just crazy compelling television.
These are set when? When were they set?
I want to say 1970s.
Right.
Yeah, and late 60s, early 70s,
How big were their mustaches?
Oh, no, not all of them have mustaches, but it's produced by David Fincher.
Oh.
Who did Zodiac and House of Cards early seasons and
Seven
all that stuff.
And, you know,
and Seven and everything else, yeah. right? But yeah, it's just so good.
What's it called again?
It's called Mindhunter.
And it's a series.
It's a series on Netflix. The first season is out on Netflix. It's incredibly popular, so I'm assuming there will be a second and third season or whatever. But it's so good.
Sounds good. Sounds
yeah.
good.
I mean, so if you're into that procedural stuff.
Who isn't?
Yeah, this is the thing.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah,
cool.
And it's got all that Fincher-esque stuff. In it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, how exciting. Okay, so that's Mindhunter.
Mindhunter.
All right. Now, my recommendation is, I don't know if you two are aware of this, but I'm very keen on a popular music performer by the name of David Bowie.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Who passed away recently.
Englishman, I believe.
That's right, yeah. He was quite big in the 70s, I don't know. And but I'm actually too young to have ever to have seen him in his glory days. You can watch a lot of his videos on YouTube, but they're of his concerts from the 1980s onwards, from 1990s. Not great performances, but for me, the excitement would have been if I could have seen him when he was the Thin White Duke.
At his peak.
When he was in 1976, how he was he's playing newly released albums and that kind of thing. But they were very remiss in those days about filming the concerts. So there's nothing. But there's a guy on YouTube by the name of, Nacho Video is his
You went down a YouTube
channel.
Rabbit hole, did you? Wow.
Well, he's done work for people like myself, which is just a gift, because he has sourced every last piece of film that's out there, from fans with their Super 8 cameras to rehearsals and everything. And he has cut these films together, these bits of film together, with the best recordings that he can find, from perhaps different concerts, but concerts from the same time. And he's labored to sync the actions of the guitarist and the words to the music. And so now you can watch a handful of things. He's only done a handful, but you can watch what looks like the real deal, the actual concert from 1976. This Nacho Video's work on, say, Station to Station, which is like a 12-minute track, when David Bowie was looking like the coolest human being that has ever lived. It's remarkable.
My hair is standing on end listening to you tell me this. This is amazing.
Well, it's incredible. He took a fan, I think it was a fan who was shooting some Super 8. He managed to get that. He got some rehearsal film and other bits and pieces, and he's put it together, and it looks seamless.
And you know what, Cam? Mm-hmm. None of this would exist in the age of lo-fi.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So my recommendation is check out this guy, Nacho Video. I don't know his actual name, but really what he's done for me, for people like me who could never watch the shows as they were at the time, is a remarkable gift. So that's mine.
Awesome.
Azmil.
All right. So I'm going to recommend actually a film. I was playing it in Taiwan recently. Invited to a film fest. And they had this concert at night where I played alongside three other protest singers. And one of them is this legendary Thai protest singer called Surachai. Famously known as Nga Caravan, which is, I mean, is noted as a founder of that folk rock genre there. But I didn't know that he was also a film director. So he co-directed this film called Tong Pan, which was released in the year I was born, the year punk broke and Elvis died, 1977. And this collective actually made this a really strong piece of, you could say, it's neo-realist film. An hour long, they're not professional actors, but the film had, of course, a very clear countercultural and activist kind of like leaning. It's about a poor farmer who's being evicted from his land. They're going to build a dam, and there's all this modernity discourse playing in the background. But what blew me away was, a lot of filmmakers were actually jailed. The film was banned. A lot of them ran to the hidden forest for a year plus because of that. But it's such a lo-fi film. If you want to talk about aesthetics, it's probably not the most, you could say, accomplished, made, you know, visually. But this is another aspect about filmmaking I find interesting. Sometimes it's the context becomes a lot more stronger than the actual, I think, the final work you see. So this is a very powerful film. And I saw it in that festival. And I was like, I've never heard of this film before. And, of course, it's not banned anymore. You can actually, I think it's been released about 10 years ago, back on VCD and DVD. So, yeah, that's my recommendation. Good luck finding it.
Yeah, good luck finding it. Yeah. So, what's it called again?
Tong Pan. T-O-N-G-P-A-N. Tong Pan.
I will have to look that up.
From 1977.
77.
So that was a cool year.
Yeah, cool year.
That was the best year, kids. Yeah. Put that in your Sega. Sega. Can't even say it.
That's a topic for next week's A Bit of Culture.
Right.
Kids don't even know what Sega is anymore.
Tong Pan.
Tong Pan, yes.
Tong Pan. That sounds cool. I like that. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's show. Only remains me to thank special honored guest, Asmil Yunor.
Thank you very much.
Asmil, you got any concerts or anything coming up?
Oh, yeah, we've got two shows coming up. Medekaria, November 8th, playing with a band. And also I'm busking, November 9th at Publica. Say hi. And December, I've got a bunch of dates. I might be playing the Penang International Jazz Fest, but the Fringe stage.
Mm-hmm. Very nice.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Very friendly.
Because Asmil's lo-fi and fringe, you see.
Yeah. Fringe, yeah.
Can't be on stage, man.
Yeah, I understand that. okay, and Uma Parkin, Umar K. Parkin.
Thank you, Cam.
Listeners can hear more of you on BFM, I suppose.
Apparently so.
Yeah. If you'd like to get in touch with us, please do so on our Facebook page. Facebook told me the other day, you know, the people who've liked the page haven't heard from you for a while. Do you want to say something?
They nag you.
Yeah, no. No, it's a place where you come for quiet contemplation. Okay. So you come to the quiet rooms of our Facebook page and press like and find peace of mind.
Oh, beautiful.
All right. Are you Instagram or anything, Asmil?
Yeah.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, Asmil, you know, is it M-Y-L-Y-U-N-O-R?
Okay. And Umar is Mr. Twitter.
I am on at Umar Pagan on Twitter, Instagram. You know the drill.
Okay. I don't say much on anything, but I'm watching you. All of you out
just
there.
Just like the government.
Yes.
Press so, the heart next time.
Yeah. So my name is Cam Ruslan, and so thank you for joining us on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it's pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.